So we saw the 12 hallmarks of aging, but the original version of the hallmarks came from Aubrey de Grey, and he defined 7 factors of aging. He called them, 7 damage types or 7 deadly things.
What does the word longevity mean?
It's frustrating and surprising to me that people are still asking this kind of question.
You hear a lot about some of these things that come out, like even in products these days, like collagen. You hear a lot about vitamin supplements that people are taking, and a lot of actually startup companies that are coming up with these vitamin supplements.
I've got 2 answers, and you're not going to like either of them. What we can say is basically nothing works.
Today, I feel like health is a commodity. There's a lot of people talking about working out. There's a lot of people talking about diets like keto and intermittent fasting and things like that. So, and people say that, like you said, it works for some people, it doesn't work for other people. A lot of people have different diets. But what is one common step in your mind that people can take towards a healthier lifestyle? Maybe even the regular blood test. What are the metrics that people should pay attention to?
Biological age can be defined at the molecular and cellular level to mean basically how much damage there is in your body.
Cumulative effects of anti-aging.
The right way to think about doing something about aging is to be combinatorial, especially ones that you can't yet do as a human being because they're not yet approved.
A lot of intervention medicine, like for example, gene editing or base editing.
We have a long way to go. The technologies that you referred to and other technologies that are correspondingly promising, things like induced pluripotent stem cells, for example, you know, these are things that were only invented very recently.
What, in your opinion, is the most promising advancement in the field of longevity right now that you think will be available to people sooner rather than later?
It's not really possible to give a hierarchy of type of damage repair technology is the most important, because you've got to repair lots of different things all at the same time.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to another exciting series of talks about longevity. And today we have the one and only Aubrey de Grey. And Nandini and I are super excited to talk to him and pick his brain from his vast knowledge about longevity and what it takes to live longer. Thank you so much for joining us, Professor Aubrey.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
To kick things off, what does the word longevity mean? And what does to live longer mean? Because everyone wants to live longer, but no one knows exactly what it means to live longer.
Honestly, your question is an example of a question that a lot of people ask. And it's frustrating and surprising to me that people are still asking this kind of question. You know, because to me, it's completely obvious that longevity is about staying healthy for longer than you otherwise might do. And as a side effect of that, staying alive for longer. You know, essentially, longevity is a side effect of health. To me, the goal here is to address the health problems that people experience when they get older, and thereby to give them greater quality of life. And as I say, as a side effect, greater quantity of life.
When you talk about it, give them greater quality of life, how much does the things that you do at a young age contribute to you living longer? For example, eating clean or working out, do these have high correlations with how long you live?
Well, there's some correlation. And of course, the big complication there is that different people have different types of metabolism and therefore different requirements in terms of how to get the most out of their bodies in that regard. Now, my work is not really related to that. My work is all about developing interventions, treatment that will work for everybody, and moreover, that will actually give far more of a postponement of the health problems of late life than anything anyone can do today, whether with lifestyle or diet or supplements or anything like that.
You know, that's interesting that you talk about interventions that you're working on. We hear a lot about some of these things that come out, like even in products these days, like collagen. We hear a lot about vitamin supplements that people are taking, and a lot of actually startup companies that are coming up with these vitamin supplements, you know, they're touting their products as things that will help reverse your biological age, or like, you know, at least least help you maintain yourself in that young form. What is your advice to folks for someone who's looking for supplements to take to extend their biological lifespan? And what is the difference between biological age and actual age? Yeah.
Okay, so I'll answer the second part first, because the second part is easy to answer. Biological age can be defined at the molecular and cellular level to mean basically how much damage there is in your body. But it can also be defined in terms of function. It can be defined as simply, you know, can you keep up with your granddaughter on the dance floor? Things like that. To the first part of your question, the part about, you know, what should people do today? I've got two answers, and you're not going to like either of them. The first answer is, I'm the wrong person to answer that question, because I'm a PhD, not an MD. I work on things that don't yet exist, rather than on things that we might be able to do today. And the second answer you're also not going to like, which is that what we can say is basically nothing works, or at least nothing works well, and the things that work a little bit are different things for different people, which means that the only generalization one can make is pay attention to your body, you know, experiment, but not too much, not too riskily. And see what, you know, what your body seems to like.
That's interesting that you say that. I agree that everybody is very different. What works for one person may not work for the other. But what are some best practices that people, you know, everybody today, I feel like health is a commodity. There's a lot of people talking about working out. There's a lot of people talking about diets like keto and intermittent fasting and things like that. So, and people say that, like you said, it works for some people. It doesn't work for other people. A lot of people have different diets, but what is one common step in your mind that people can take towards a healthier lifestyle?
Since people are so different, we've got to understand that, like, self-assessment is the big thing, that you've got to just figure out what works for you. So you meant at the beginning of your question, you mentioned exercise, working out, right?
Yeah.
Some people need to do a lot more of that than others, but at the end of the day, the way that you tell how much you need is by telling, you know, whether you're putting on weight, you know, whether you're losing, you know, energy or whatever, you know, do enough exercise to stop that from happening. And absolutely, that juxtaposes with what you eat. Best way not to put on weight is not to eat so much, rather than just to do more exercise to remove the weight that you put on. And exactly what you can eat, you know, some people have much better sugar tolerance than others, things like that. So it's like, it's completely impossible to generalize. You have to just do the experiment on yourself.
And what are the metrics that people should pay attention to? Like you said, you need to be aware of your body, right? So maybe even the regular blood test. What are the metrics that people should pay attention to? And how often should they be looking at those?
The blood tests are great, but even without any kind of going to a doctor or anything, just a measure of, yeah, I mean, everyone can weigh themselves, right? Everybody can tell, you know, whether they take a long time to get up to speed and energetically, you know, first thing in the morning, you know, whether they can think straight. It's just that level of function is really what matters, right? And those are the things that one can self-assess pretty objectively.
I know you spoke about your core research in intervention. So is this more intervention on anti-aging? Because I was recently reading this research by this professor at UPenn, Josh Mitteldorf, in the whole study that they're trying to do with the cumulative effects of anti-aging and how different interventions, they want to do a comparative study on the cumulative anti-aging that they're able to achieve.
I know, Josh. I'm not completely familiar with the study that you're talking about, but for sure, the right way to think about doing something about aging is to be combinatorial, to look at doing a big panel of interventions all at the same time. So my work is focused on combinatorial interventions as well, on especially ones that you can't yet do as a human being because they're not yet approved or whatever, so we do them in mice. But the same logic applies, absolutely. The body is this really complicated machine that accumulates all manner of different types of damage, and a lot of those types of damage, each of them can kill you on their own, however well we fix all the others. So you've got to have this multifaceted approach in order to actually achieve something.
Of late, I have also come across a lot of biotech startups that do a lot of intervention medicine, like, for example, gene editing or base editing kind of biotech startup that work on specialized diseases, for the lack of a better word, like, for example, recoding your cholesterol or HDL or LDL genes to prevent you from having cholesterol and stuff. How effective are these? And what does initial data suggest about these research? And are we headed in the right direction in achieving what we set out to achieve in the beginning?
I believe we're definitely headed in the right direction, but we have a long way to go. The technologies that you referred to and other technologies that are correspondingly promising, things like induced pluripotent stem cells, for example, you know, these are things that were only invented very recently, and people are still very much in the early stages of figuring out how to get the most out of what we can do with them. These are platform technologies, they're often called. These are, in other words, things that could be used in many, many different ways, both in terms of how well they work and in terms of how safe they are. You know, lots and lots of refinements are being explored. These are big research areas, but the potential is enormous.
You spoke about the research that you're doing, right? When I think about longevity, I think about the field being such a vast field that so many people are working on. What, in your opinion, like we just had a session with Fiona and she spoke about senolescence. So what, in your opinion, is the most promising advancement in the field of longevity right now that you think will be available to people sooner rather than later?
Well, the difficulty with answering that question is what I said earlier about the body being this really complicated machine that accumulates a lot of different types of damage. It's not really possible to give a hierarchy of which type of damage repair technology is the most important, because you've got to repair lots of different things all at the same time. Now, we can certainly say which of the damage repair technologies are advancing the most rapidly. Certainly, senolytics are going very well. But the way that we can see that either is just in the laboratory, you know, with model organisms, with laboratory animals rather than with humans. Or else, if we are talking about humans, then it's typically being applied to humans who have some specific disease, an early onset disease that is characterized by the accelerated accumulation of a particular type of damage. So, for example, senescent cells. Now, if these things can be treated with such and such therapy, then great. It means that the therapy is also quite likely to work on the elderly. It's just that when we apply it to the elderly on its own, it's not going to give much benefit because we're not doing all the others. So that's why the time is right to be starting to work on combination.
I've also heard the theory about when I read this whole book around the breakthrough and the whole immuno-oncology treatment that life sciences companies now come up with, rather than just generalized chemotherapy treatments for cancer. There was a talk about wanting to create something like a digital twin, in wanting to test combinatory medicine on that twin that replicates a person's body. How far have we gotten on that front? Because that seemed way more safer in wanting to go test out medicines rather than actually going and doing it on an actual person and do trial and error. That as a concept sounded super interesting. How does that translate to the space of longevity and wanting to try out interventional medication?
Yeah, so absolutely. This is a fascinating concept. I think what we need to do at this point is not to get too far ahead of ourselves in terms of how useful this kind of technology is. At the end of the day, the whole digital twin idea is potentially wonderful, that one might be able to test future treatments for people without actually any safety concerns, because you're actually testing them on some kind of in silico simulation. But on the other hand, you know, that simulation has a certain degree of fidelity, a certain degree of risk that it's not going to be telling you the right answer, because somehow it was not quite a twin, you know, it was not quite the same as the person it was supposed to be. And we are getting better at simulating how such and such a thing would impact a real biological organism by doing in silico, but we're still not very good at it. It's rather the same as the situation with regards to measurements of biological age across species. You know, something works in mice or in other laboratory animals, then it might work in humans, but it might not. And the technologies that we're developing, the omics technologies like epigenetic clocks, purporting to improve our understanding, our predictive power with regard to that, they're definitely better than nothing, but they've definitely got a long way to go.
And what impacts of AI and ML do you see in this space? Like, I know you talk about prediction in your previous answer. A selfish motive for me is because I do data science. Curious about the applications of AI and ML. And do you see that actually aiding in the whole longevity research?
For sure. Yeah. So AI and machine learning have absolutely already made a huge difference, and they will continue to do so. But one thing I should emphasize is that the main ways in which they are doing so, in which they are contributing to longevity research, is not specific to longevity research, but rather it applies across the whole of biomedical research. Here I'm thinking about, well, I mean, the most conspicuous example that I think most people have probably heard of by now is AlphaFold, this wonderful program that predicts the three-dimensional shape of proteins by looking at their amino acid sequence. And, you know, that's got a long way to go. We're now going to be in a position fairly soon, I think, where we can actually build a protein with a specific function by deciding what shape we'd like it to have, and then essentially reverse engineering the amino acid sequence from that, you know, to build something that never existed in nature in the first place. You know, that is by no means beyond the realms of where we could expect to be fairly soon. Drug discovery, drug repurposing, identifying, you know, getting data from how a drug has been used in a particular patient group that it was approved for, and figuring out whether it might work for a completely different condition. I've already seen some success.
There are a lot of people currently working on maintenance of biological age, right? Do you think it's possible to reverse biological age?
Absolutely. However, what I should emphasize is I don't think it's really possible to reverse biological age today. Okay. Essentially, what I work on is reversing biological age, because what that means is repairing the damage that the body does to itself throughout life and that eventually kills it. And right. The treatments that I've been doing the early stage development on for the past 10 or 15 years in my various organizations have been precisely focused on exactly that, especially on the most difficult type of damage, the ones that most people feel are too difficult to fix.
This has been a fun mini series so far, but I do want to ask one more question. I feel like we were all getting educated on health, even starting like the early 2010 and going forward. I think health was becoming a big commodity. But we all know that in 2020, we were thrown kind of a curveball, right, with the coronavirus and the pandemic and everything, which kind of altered a lot of things for a lot of people. So what are the studies for the virus that were done in the field of longevity? You know, there are a lot of people who are still talking about side effects of the virus, people who did get the virus and who did recover. And how does the effects of the virus, you know, affect your biological age, and what damage does it do to your body?
The answer to your question is still really not known. The effects of COVID, especially the enormously variable effects on COVID, with some people having very long-term symptoms and other people recovering almost at once. This is something that's still hugely enigmatic. You know, there's a huge amount that we still don't understand about that. However, I think I want to give us another answer to your question, which is perhaps a little more indirect, but perhaps quite important, which is that COVID overwhelmingly affected the elderly or those with conditions of late life. And, you know, that's not unusual. That's pretty much the standard for most infections. They affect the elderly worse. But what we should learn from this, if we want to actually minimize the impact of the next pandemic, because there's going to be one, is we should be working really hard to figure out ways to rejuvenate the immune systems of the elderly, which really means rejuvenating the elderly in general, because the immune system is very pervasive. If people could get that message, this is a time bomb. You know, we really absolutely have to figure out as best we possibly can.
I wanted to pick your brain on your advocacy side, because I know you do research, but you are an advocate as well for longevity. Three layman questions. The first question I have is, how confident are you in its adoption?
So that's an easy question. Nobody wants to get sick. So once we have things that actually work, the adoption is going to be universal, no question at all. However much people may try to make excuses for aging today and try to pretend that it's a blessing in disguise, it's all charade. So my advocacy efforts are not really around that. They are around what might happen at an earlier stage, between now and then. People often say, you know, big pharma is all about keeping people alive in a sick state of health rather than keeping people healthy. You know, that needs to change. And the way it will change is by educating society and decision makers and policy makers, and for that matter, educating Big Pharma itself. But once these things are really, you know, ready for prime time and they're out there, then my job will be done.
Some of these longevity supplements, a common thing that I hear is, hey, they aren't FDA approved. So if they aren't FDA approved, how are we supposed to consume it?
The FDA is not really the bad guy. The FDA is like just implementing the law. They want to save lives, same as the rest of us do. The more they can actually accommodate the innovations that are coming down, the more they will do so. We've already seen in the past few years a couple of really good improvements in that regard, where first of all, the most important one is that the FDA has more or less recognized that aging is a medical condition that they need to be approving treatments for if those treatments can be demonstrated to be safe and effective. That's a huge change. Historically, the main reason why the FDA was not doing that was because the people who study the biology of aging were not telling them in an authoritative way what aging even is.
What are you most excited about this research space in? What should the world look forward to in the next 5 to 10 years in this research space?
I mean, the thing I'm most excited about is the acceleration that's happening. Things that were still very much hidden away in my organization's laboratories or in a few other places are now already, you know, far enough along that they've been spun out as private, as startup companies, you know, with actual investors putting money into them. And more than that, there is now a wider acceptance in society that this is a meaningful crusade. So, you know, that's what excites me the most.
I think also to add to that, the developing technology these days, like you said, with AI and machine learning is definitely going to help further the developments in the field. Thank you so much for joining us, Professor Aubrey. We'll have you back on if our audience has any questions for you as well. In all of our conversations, there's been this word that's been thrown around here and there, and I'm sure you guys are wondering what it means. That word is senolytics.
What is a senescent cell?
A senescent cell is essentially a cell that stopped dividing by a variety of reasons. This concept was actually coined in the 1960s. Cells have like in them some kind of a trigger that stops cell division. The problem is that senescent cells don't just sit there. They release a bunch of proteins, including growth factors and pro-inflammatory cytokines. That it means that they attract and trigger cells of the immune system. And they have deleterious effects. Turns out that some of these senescent cells, some of these proteins produced by these cells may actually help tissue repair. But the majority, or that's the current conception, the majority of these effects are bad for the body. They show that by removing genetically senescent cells in mice, they have a great effect in just the overall frailty and like health of the mice. The fur looked better, the tissues look better. This is like removing with 100% selectivity and 100% efficacy. Senescent cells have an upregulation of anti-apoptotic mechanisms. They are resistant to normal inducers of apoptosis. So the premise was like, if we inhibit the auto-apoptosis mechanisms, senescent cells rely on these mechanisms, senescent cells will preferentially die. The problem is that normal cells also have anti-apoptotic mechanisms. Even if they are less dependent on them, it might affect normal cells. And it's the same principle with cancer therapy. As a matter of fact, some of the first senolytics were actually also drugs used to treat cancers. And what do you guys think was the first disease that was targeted in senescent cells?
Cancer?
No, I think that's too far ahead. Maybe they started with something small like cholesterol buildup.
No, it's with pulmonary fibrosis.